philosophical exploration of whether it is rational to believe in miracles. What are the principles involved here? And that is part of what today people call philosophy of religion. Philosophers had sort of cast out religion in the early 20th century and even before that. It was not really a serious topic. That began to change around the 1970s, in particular with Richard Swinburne and Alvin Plantinga and others. And now it's a huge field. So many philosophers are writing about theological topics, such as the existence of God, certainly, but also so-called hiddenness of God or the questions of an afterlife, religious experience, theodicy, even atonement, believe it or not, and miracles. And so there we are, miracles. And miracles, that's in itself a complex and far-reaching topic, and I cannot treat all of that tonight. I mean, we can get into all sorts of directions in the question and answer. But I thought I'll do two parts. First part is about the possibility of miracles. And the second, the actuality of miracles. If something is not possible, then by definition it's not actual. On the other hand, if something is actual and proven to be actual, then it must be possible. That's implied. That's how the two hang together. Now, before I get into these two parts, just a few general introductory kind of comments. If I ask whether it's rational to believe in miracles, probably the contemporary knee-jerk reaction will be no, it's not, you know. And it might be something for superstitious people or simple-minded people or for bygone ages. And those kind of outlooks are not limited to secular minds. Even theologians and scripture scholars say things like that. So here's a quote from Rudolf Bultmann, famous Protestant theologian and scripture scholar. Quote, "It is impossible to use electric light and the wireless and to avail ourselves of modern medical and surgical discoveries and at the same time to believe in the New Testament world of spirits and miracles." Now, if I ask you where the argument here is, I don't think there is an argument. There is that's just a bare claim, you know, and it's more an expression of a bias. Certainly we have all sorts of technology today, but what does that have to do with the claim whether miracles are possible or not? You know, that is decided on completely different grounds. And that miracles are in the face of what we know by science and by our notions of nature, that's nothing new. That was true in New Testament times too. That's why people in New Testament times knew that these were miracles. Otherwise, they wouldn't call it that way. So there is really nothing new here, and there's no argument here either. It's a non sequitur. Now we can switch that and ask, so that's how it looks from the outside. What about believers? How about people who have no problem believing in miracles in principle? Well, I'm going to speak from a Christian and more specifically Catholic point of view, just to give you that perspective. This is actually less straightforward than you would expect. So on the one hand, miracles are absolutely central to Christianity. Christianity is founded on a miracle, the miracle of the resurrection. That's where it began. So if miracles are not possible, right, or actual, forget about Christianity. We are done, basically, right? So this is not a minor topic at all. And miracles are there to authenticate revelation. So if you have a prophet who has a message and says, well, this message is from God, and I'm going to demonstrate that to you by working this kind of miracle. Think of the Old Testament prophets. That is how it typically works. And that is also how it works for Jesus. So Jesus claims to be God. And it is authenticated by him rising from the dead. We could get further into that question. So you cannot say Jesus didn't rise from the dead, he was just a good and wise person. He made a claim to be God. You know, either he's a fraud, or he's a madman, you know, but or it's actually true, and he is God. You know, and the resurrection authenticates that. So, but it is indeed central to Christianity that miracles must be possible, and Christianity in some way is more vulnerable than other religions to that question. So, from the inside of the faith, miracles are important, and yet the faith itself has a certain kind of skepticism about miracles. It can go in all sorts of directions, but first of all, the church, for example, does not easily acknowledge something to be a miracle. There's a whole apparatus of tests and committees looking at all sorts of claims before anything might possibly be acknowledged as a miracle. And so it's not any kind of blind faith. In fact, you know, if you think of places like Lourdes and the miracles there in France, these are healing miracles, there are many, many healings that have taken place, and they go through all sorts of panels and discussions, and very, very few are acknowledged as really authenticated by the church. And they have to go through three kind of panels, and in each of them you have atheist doctors. Now that's important. Atheist doctors, why are there atheist doctors on that? Well, as I just said, miracles are there to authenticate a claim to a revelation, right? That means miracles are there to authenticate something to someone who does not yet believe. Now, sometimes people say, well, I don't have a problem believing in miracles, you know, I believe in Jesus and all that, so miracles are just fine, and I just expect that, you know. That's good, but that's not the function of miracles. You know, the miracles are for those people who don't believe yet. You know, as Jesus says, if you don't believe me, at least believe the works I'm doing, that is the miracles, you know. And so here too, these miracles must be visible to sort of the naked eye, if you want, you know, that doesn't have yet the faith. So if an atheist doctor can say, well, there was a miracle here, or at least there is something I cannot explain, that means much more. And they're willing to state that. You know, it's not that they're necessarily converted by the evidence and now suddenly become Catholic, but they are willing to state, this is something we cannot naturally explain. All of this, I'm just saying, to illustrate that the church herself is very careful about any of these claims. And that was always the case. Thomas Aquinas is careful to distinguish true and absolutely speaking miracles from things that are just wondrous, you know, that might be astonishing but are not really miracles in a strict sense. So they have their own kind of care about this. St. Augustine initially did not believe that miracles would take place. He thought that ended with the apostles. That's what we call a cessationist position. Most Protestant denominations have that, not all, but some, that with the death of the last apostle there wouldn't be any miracles anymore. That was just for the early spread of Christianity. And St. Augustine believed that too initially, and then he changed his mind. What happened? He had become the Bishop of Hippo, and he had to investigate all these miracle claims, and he found some that are really good. And so there's a whole long section of the City of God where he describes all these miracles. So, but indeed, there is a certain kind of skepticism. Now, there are other theological reservations people will have, and so there are some theologians who say miracles are more like well, let me give you an example. A little boy is playing on a train track. And from a distance, there approaches this high-speed train, you know, and it's just predictable. The boy is not moving, and the train is just going to kill the boy. Instead, the train is starting, is coming to a screeching halt, stopping just a few inches in front of the boy. A miracle. You know, the mother's running and says, oh, God saved my child. a miracle. It turns out on inspection, what happened is the train driver fell asleep and let go of the ledger or whatever that is that he has, a lever that he has to hold down so that the train can run. And so just so happened, you know, the train happened to stop there. A chance event, perhaps, you know, good luck, and but not a miracle. And yet, the mother will continue to thank God for saving her child. Right? So, that would be one way of looking at miracles. They would have a natural explanation, but they are not miraculous in the sense that a law of nature was broken, perhaps, you know. It is not an intervention that puts out of gear the rest of the world or something of that sort. It is all perfectly explicable. Now, there are a number of problems if we say that's the only way miracles can happen. This is certainly one way in which God can intervene or arrange things. It is a case of what we call special providence. You know, God governs the whole of the universe with all its elements in it, including its normal operations. And so God, in his providence, can arrange that all these normal things converge in such a way that the train is going to stop there. Right? That's God's special providence, and it's part of his care for his creatures. But is it a miracle? An atheist could be perfectly fine with that. You know, if you just looked at it, sure, you know, I understand that the woman is grateful, and we always said that. I mean, religion is just wishful thinking, right? It's something that's completely explicable, and you just project your wishes on that, and it's completely subjective. You know, for perhaps the somebody else living a few blocks down the street, it's not a miracle because you couldn't care less, right? It's only relative to your expectations or wishes. I don't think that's enough to call something a miracle. You know, nobody would take that as something that authenticates revelation, because it's easily explained away. And it is more like winning the lottery, you know. It's an extremely unlikely thing that you win the lottery, but it's not impossible. After all, someone does win the lottery, you know, eventually. And so that wouldn't be sufficient as an explanation, I think. In fact, if we say that this is the only way miracles can happen, that is itself a pretty massive claim, because we make a claim about what God cannot do. The implication is God cannot change the laws of nature. He cannot interrupt the laws of nature. He would be like us. We cannot break the laws of nature, right? And but to say that of God means you're making a statement about who God is. You're making a statement about the very nature of God. And I think that helps us to see in turn what we do claim if we say God works miracles. Namely, God is the author of the laws of nature, and therefore he reigns the sovereign over these laws and can change them. He can abrogate them at a particular point in time if he so wishes. What we see, therefore, is that God transcends the order of nature because he's the author and creator of nature. And one of the functions of miracles is precisely to bring that to our awareness, that the laws of nature do not have the last word, but that it is God from whom they come in the first place. If that were not so, even some of our practices as believers would be unintelligible. For example, prayer. Prayer for miracles. If I pray for a healing of somebody, a miraculous healing, I implicitly believe that God can work miracles. And if I didn't believe that, I better stop praying, because it's irrational. So, it is important. Miracles do tell us something about God. That's one of the reasons why God will work miracles, because he wants to tell us something about himself. If we assume that the universe has a beginning, like the Big Bang, you know, and if we say the Big Bang really is the beginning of the physical universe with all that's in it, including the laws that govern the universe, then the Big Bang itself must be of that kind. Because the Big Bang does not happen because of the laws of nature. The laws of nature don't exist before the Big Bang. The universe and the laws come together into being at once, and they're made by God. And so the Big Bang, or the creation of the universe as a whole, might be something analogous to a true miracle. Any miracle is of that scale, if you want, any absolute miracle. So what we indeed find out, therefore, God can change the laws of nature. That also means there could be different laws of nature. God can change that, then these laws of nature are not absolutely necessary. Which might lead us theologically then to ask, why did God choose these laws of nature and not other laws? These laws would then show that, it would show that these laws themselves are an expression of God's care for his creatures, for us. And therefore, they are actually not in contradiction with the miracles themselves in that sense. So these are more general questions that people will raise when it comes to the possibility of miracles. That is, the question of whether they are, metaphysically speaking, possible, whether laws of nature hold absolutely, let's say with logical necessity, or not. On those questions it is decided whether these are possible or not. If, for example, you are a pantheist, like, say, Spinoza, you will not allow miracles to be possible. And Spinoza is quite explicit on that. That is, if everything is God, then everything is as necessary as God himself is. And everything is as necessary as 2 plus 2 is 4. And that means if God were to change that, he would break not only all sorts of laws, he would break himself. He would contradict his very own nature. And so Spinoza therefore said miracles are impossible. So we see there's a very fundamental level on which it is decided whether laws, whether miracles are possible or not. And they tell us indeed something about who God himself is. Now let's say that clarifies some of the questions about the possibility of miracles. Now I'm going to talk about the actuality of miracles. So let's assume we have shown that miracles are in principle possible. It could very well be that then miracles are also actual. Miracles do happen. Now there is a famous objection by David Hume that says that even if miracles were actual, we would never know. You could never prove it. Which would, undermine the whole function of miracles too. And so I will dwell a little bit on that right now. And I'll do a little bit more reading here because some of the points are subtle and I want to make sure that's worded correctly. And so I'll first of all explain to you what Hume's argument is and then why he's wrong. So, first of all, Hume's argument is not that the laws of nature cannot be violated. He couldn't make that claim because he doesn't think there is such a thing as causality or that there are laws of that sort. That just we are accustomed to seeing things happen regularly. That's all he says we can know. So he wouldn't have any grounds to deny that possibility in principle. So that's not his argument. Sometimes people confuse that. He cannot make this argument since he himself is famously skeptical about any evidence for the very fact of causality in nature, let alone for the necessity of its laws. According to Hume, we only observe regularities, not causality. And we call these observed regularities laws of nature. These regularities, however, are enough for Hume to make it impossible, so he thinks, to make it impossible for us to ever have enough evidence for a miracle. His claim is that even if a miracle had occurred, we could never know it. Why not? For Hume, establishing the actuality of a miracle is just a matter of weighing the evidence. And he claims that the evidence for the actuality of a miracle will never add up to certainty or even probability. The reason is that miracles are, by definition, improbable. The laws of nature which they violate have been established by the repeated testimony of our senses and have the common observations of all of past humanity in their favor. A miracle contradicts all of this previous testimony. It might be attested by only one or a few sightings. As an interruption of the laws and as an exception, the miracle is rare. By definition, then, the actuality of a miracle is always less probable than the law of nature that it interrupts. Thus, its occurrence cannot be established or be made probable. That's basically, in a nutshell, Hume's argument. To make matters worse, many miracle claims involve historical cases, of which we know only the documents that have been handed down to us. Again, even if these documentary witnesses are trustworthy, which Hume denies, they always provide less evidence in favor of the miracles than the laws that they break. Now, there's an additional argument that the philosopher Anthony Flew made. Maybe you've heard that name, famous atheist philosopher. Anthony Flew reinforces Hume's argument about historical cases by pointing to the fact that scientific laws can still be tested and confirmed here and now. The miraculous event, on the other hand, cannot so be tested, and this for two reasons. The alleged event is in the past, that's the one reason, and the other, it is a particular, unique event that is, by definition, something that is not repeatable. So that's pretty, makes it pretty difficult, right, for a miracle claim to be established. And Flew adds that the historical record itself can be a conduit of information only if we assume that the laws of nature are reliably operating, for only then can we rationally interpret the detritus of the past as evidence for such an event and construct from it our account of what actually happened. In other words, he says, our sole ground for characterizing a reported occurrence as miraculous is at the same time a sufficient reason for calling it physically impossible. Now, there are already some strengthening things here. I mean, everybody would say it's physically impossible. Of course it is, you know. But let's leave that there. I'll come back to that argument too. But so why should we think that Hume and Flew are wrong? As a first counter-argument, it has been argued that David Hume overstates his case when he claims, as he says, that laws of nature constitute a uniform experience against every miraculous event. So there's laws of nature hold uniformly, and therefore there's always uniform evidence against them. With this claim, he begs the question, because this claim presupposes what needs to be proved, namely the non-existence of miracles. In fact, the evidence for the experience of miracles in all cultures might be much larger than that of the small group of secular Western academics of recent years, which question them. It's a two-volume thick book by Craig Keener, who documents all these cases of miracles that are going on even today in the third world and miracle claims. They're much more ubiquitous than people think. So just to think this is just, you know, a curiosity in history, that is how it might look like if you are sort of in Berkeley, perhaps, in a Western academic ivory tower, perhaps. Yeah, but in the common experience of people, they are very widespread. So that's one argument one can make against, but that's not the argument I actually want to make here. After all, it is true that in everyone's experience, miracles, if they are experienced at all, are experienced more rarely than the laws of nature on which we rely every day. My first point is rather that individual experience as such does count. especially if there's nothing in Hume's metaphysics to rule out exceptions a priori. Precisely as an empiricist, Hume cannot claim more than an incomplete induction for laws of nature. And this is true not just for empiricists, but more generally. Our evidence for the universal and necessary valid laws of nature is always incomplete. You can never test all the cases, you know, of which there are an instance. And therefore, there's nothing in the evidence that rules out the possibility of miracles in principle. Now, if this is so, then there's nothing in miracles that constitutes a logical contradiction with our evidence for the laws of nature. Therefore, miracle claims should not be a priori and dogmatically discarded, but rather investigated. Nor are they discredited by the fact that they do not occur regularly. Improbable things do happen after all. Winning in the lottery is improbable too, but people do win and there's evidence for it. In fact, if Hume were right, then there would not even be progress in science. After all, we can falsify our current theories of what the laws of nature are and then replace them with better ones. Rather than being inviolable, we can come across evidence that does not obey what we had so far believed to be inviolable laws of nature. Such evidence has been discussed under the name of recalcitrant cases, and they play a role in the process of scientific progress. For David Hume, however, such recalcitrant evidence is to be a priori dismissed. As he indicates at one point, a prince in faraway India who hears for the first time of the phenomenon of frost, which does not exist in his own climate, should rightly dismiss such evidence as a mere fairy tale. And so perhaps we should also have dismissed the first reports of black swans in Australia as a mere superstition, or even as an attempt at malicious deception. But if so, then we should never have been able to change our mind. Nor, more generally, would we ever be able to test and falsify our current paradigms. Now, being pressed on this point, Hume might still answer that if indeed the evidence adds up, then he would be willing to surrender the paradigm. The problem with that suggestion, however, is that on his own theory, this adding up of evidence could, of course, never happen. For all those instances that could add up are to be dismissed, simply because they are individual cases. And if each individual case is dismissed, then all are dismissed. Mere zeros do not add up to anything. In sum, they remain zero. Still, let us cut Hume even more slack. Let us grant him, for the sake of argument, that the individual cases somehow indeed would add up. Even so, do we even have to wait for evidence to add up? Hume would require us to wait for so much evidence that it would trump the cumulative evidence for all of our previous paradigms. But this is not, in fact, correct. Consider the possibility of coming across a recalcitrant case, some one piece of evidence that all by itself suggests to us a paradigm shift. It might not by itself be enough evidence to confirm that new paradigm or law that we establish. But I do not think that this kind of confirmation is required. According to Karl Popper, paradigms and hypotheses do not need to be confirmed in order to be acceptable scientific theories. For that, they only need to be falsifiable. That is, it must be possible to prove them wrong empirically. If a recalcitrant case leads us to propose a new theory, including one perhaps that suggests a supernatural cause, then it is not irrational to accept it. Rather, it is possible to state the conditions under which the new paradigm would be falsified, and it is rational to proceed and investigate it then empirically. In addition, it is very important to realize that against Hume's crucial assumption, the recalcitrant new evidence for the new paradigm does not have to outweigh the old evidence. Why? The reason is that there is no contradiction between the new paradigm and the evidence for the old paradigm. It is the aim of the new paradigm to explain not only the new evidence, but also the old. Hence, the new paradigm will indeed explain even the old evidence better and more comprehensively. And if it does so, then all the old evidence that Hume claims speaks against the new paradigm now speaks, in fact, for it. I think that's the point that's often overlooked. You know, I think people are browbeaten by Hume's argument here, but that's just simply looking at it completely wrong. Now, this is true for scientific theory. So you have one scientific paradigm with a set of natural laws, and you find new evidence, and based on that, you change that, and that then explains the new evidence, but also the old better. You know, that's a perfectly rational kind of progress. This is for scientific theories. Is that also true for miracles? Miracles are, as we just said, after all, unique and peculiar. They do not amount to evidence for a new law of nature. They are still defined by contrast with such laws. Nevertheless, there is a way in which they too can establish a new paradigm. Consider someone who is converted by witnessing a miracle. And so as to go to the heart of the matter, consider the apostles being confronted with the risen Jesus. The gospel narratives illustrate what such a paradigm shift might look like, how the evidence for the resurrection may take a bit of time to sink in, how there can be an initial dismissal of the evidence, and yet at the end it does indeed produce a new outlook. Is that shift irrational because it contradicts our previous evidence? No, because this new outlook, in this new outlook, all the old evidence looks different. The old evidence will not contradict the new paradigm, but it is suddenly evident what the evidence had meant all the way along. This is true particularly for all the previous religious experience and all the evidence that could be adduced for the faith of ancient Israel. So it is more like, if you take, C.S. Lewis uses that example, you find a lost chapter of a novel, right? So you have always read the novel with that one missing chapter. There are certain things that didn't quite make sense, but you had sort of a theory of what the whole thing means. Now you suddenly discover the manuscript with that chapter that was always meant to be part of that, and now suddenly everything appears in a new light. You might have to revise your understanding of the meaning of the whole thing in the light of what you know now, but it now makes all sense. It all makes sense. Right? So there's nothing that contradicts the new evidence or the new understanding. Rather, it's the other way around. The new understanding explains everything better. Now, the new paradigm that perhaps, let's say, the resurrection is, you get a Christian perspective of the world. You know, and, that includes, again, the faith of ancient Israel, explains that in so many ways, or helps us understand what the prophecies have meant all the way along. But it actually also includes our understandings of the laws of nature. The new paradigm will also include the evidence for the regular and ordinary behavior of nature and its laws. Having come to know God as someone who reveals himself in extraordinary events in history would not have led the apostles to disbelieve in a God who orders the ordinary course of nature according to predictable laws. In fact, it is the same care that leads God to reveal himself which also motivates him to provide for us laws of nature that make our environments sufficiently predictable and intelligible. Evidence for laws of nature are not evidence against miracles. Rather, they are just more evidence for the same God who also works miracles. So it really fits together and in a very rational picture. There's no contradiction in the evidence here. Contrary to Hume, then, nothing in this faith is irrational, and nothing in miracles requires us to dismiss any evidence. Rather, it is David Hume who needs to dismiss the given evidence of miracles dogmatically and a priori. Now, what about the historical argument enhanced by Anthony Flew? After all, we are not the apostles. We are not eyewitnesses to the resurrection. We live 2,000 years later and have to rely on documents that others might call into doubt. I will not engage the specific case for the resurrection here, although a surprisingly good case has been made for the historical evidence for that event too. But I want to look at these claims in general and more on principle. And the first common misunderstanding that one probably needs to address is from the philosopher Ernst Troeltsch. I don't know if that name.
And that's the principle of analogy.
Which states that the past is not dissimilar to our present experience. So if a historian looks at the past, the assumption should be it is like the present. On this basis, the common claim is made that miracles do not happen today, and therefore, by analogy, historians should therefore dismiss miracle claims about past events as well. The historical method would inherently be restricted to non-miraculous events. Yet what this principle of analogy can reasonably mean is only that we should evaluate testimony from the past in the same way as we evaluate testimony from the present. Put in this way, the analogy is not an analogy between present and past events, but an analogy of the methods to be employed in the investigation of events. So the events in the past, I think, can be quite different from what they are in the present, but we should use the same methods to investigate them. In fact, you know, they will be different because historical events, by virtue of being historical events, are unique. You know, others have pointed that out. Unlike the cycles of nature, history doesn't repeat, really. You know, they are unique. And so we shouldn't expect that everything is like today. You know, they will be different by their very nature. So after all, not just miracles, but history as such is by definition unique and unrepeatable, as Reinhold Niebuhr has pointed out. If the principle of analogy were applied to the events themselves, we could not have historiography. The only plausible application is an analogy of method, not of content. And that still allows for all the critical analysis a modern historian will be interested in. If certain conditions of the present are known to produce illusions, such as the taking of drugs, then we should assume that analogously, witnesses on drugs in the past might have been deluded as well. So if we had no evidence that the apostles were on drugs, then maybe we shouldn't believe their testimony. But this analogy does not exclude that things happen in the past that do not happen today. In fact, the same methods might lead us to believe that reports about unusual things are truthful under certain circumstances. The same methods that should make us disbelieve certain accounts should also make us believe others. Dismissing dissimilar events as such risks an uncritical projection of our peculiar Western contemporary prejudices and agendas onto the past. In the context of miracles, this dismissal might even ignore the fact that miracles are also reported today, which Troeltsch seems to assume is not the case. That is, not just among barbarous and ignorant nations, as David Hume says. The dismissal of miracle claims for the past might even be violating the very principle of analogy in Troeltsch's understanding. So indeed, then, nothing in the historical method precludes the possibility of miracles in the past. Now this, again, is the possibility, does not prove the actuality of these miracles. What are those analogous methods that allow us to establish the actuality of a miracle in history? Anthony Flew maintains that as a unique and past event, it cannot be scientifically tested, as I said that earlier. This, however, is not true. And for the very reasons to which Anthony Flew appeals, he correctly insists that our interpretation of the detritus, or what is left over from the past, requires us to assume that the laws of nature are operative in order for us to be able to extrapolate to past events. But is it true that we can therefore never access an event that is not itself an expression of these laws? So we need, if you have a tool that investigates past evidence, that relies on the laws of nature to operate, right? Can you come by that investigation to evidence for something that precisely is not operating according to these laws? I think you can. And one example I mentioned already, it's the Big Bang. How do we know about the Big Bang? And I said it's sort of an analogous kind of thing for a miracle. It's a unique historical event of the past that we cannot itself today replicate or test in the laboratory. This event certainly is far more distant in the past than all miracles ever reported. And there were not even any eyewitnesses for it. At the Big Bang, presumably neither time nor space nor the laws of nature existed. It is a unique event that has all the marks of a miracle, that is, of a supernatural initiative by a non-physical agent. And yet, we know about the event only by virtue of tracing things back from contemporary evidence along the laws of nature that we know. We extrapolate back by using the laws of nature that there must be such an event that is not explained by the laws of nature. That's exactly what we do if we investigate miracle claims. This means that we use a scientific method involving a principle of analogy, and the method leads us back precisely to a non-analogous, unique historical event. Can we apply such methods to miracles? What might help us here is something Hume did not know about, namely the modern methods of criminology and scientific forensic investigation. As Richard Swinburne points out, Hume did not take into account physical traces such as can be left on a crime scene, cigarette ashes, fingerprints, bomb craters, or pollen. In addition, we have methods of radiocarbon dating, dendrochronology, and archaeological methods, and other tests that allow us to gather evidence about historical events. The interesting point is that this evidence about the past is present evidence. You know, you have archaeological evidence now and other kinds of things. The evidence is observable now under the microscope and other testing devices. And as such, it can also be subjected to repeated testing. And indeed, so even if the event is unique, the method by which you investigate it is repeatable. And indeed, the church has had such tests applied to the Shroud of Turin, for example. This, for example, the pollen method is, and other kind of things are used there. Or to the tomb of San Juan Diego, Our Lady of Guadalupe. Contrary to Anthony Flew, there are repeatable experiments that we can make about the past, and we can repeat these experiments potentially indefinitely. In this manner, sufficient evidence can easily accumulate. Moreover, contrary to Richard Swinburne, I do not think that proving a miracle is a matter of really cumulative probabilities that you just add up the evidence. This would already concede too much to David Hume. Rather, as has been seen earlier in our discussions of paradigm shifts, such a proof is not a mere matter of quantities. The testing scenario suggests something rather different than weighing or adding up of evidence. David Hume says, no testimony is sufficient to establish a miracle unless the testimony be of such a kind that its falsehood would be more miraculous than the fact which it endeavors to establish. Well, I think that's exactly the case, and here's why. let's say... we have these testing devices by which we investigate, you know, the Shroud of Turin or something like that. And let's say we have evidence for a miraculous intervention of some sorts. Then let's say you have here the usual course of things according to the laws of nature. But somewhere in between here is a disruption. There's an event that's not explained by the laws of nature and might be contrary to it, whatever that means. That's another question to discuss. So what we would do if you investigate that, let's say here we have a microscope or telescope or whatever the case might be, and we look through that at the evidence. Now the process by which I can look at the evidence, and that follows the laws of nature. So, I mean, the tools that I'm using, the testing devices, are built according to the laws of nature.
for example, the laws of optics, you know, the lenses that I'm crafting for it and so forth. So not only here do you have a line of laws of nature, but also here. So what happens if I come across evidence for a miracle? Well, David Hume would say, well, that you still have all the evidence for the usual cause of things here. And so that would be contradicted by this one evidence, and that doesn't count much. You know. It must at least be as miraculous as what we observe here. Now, but notice if we say, no, there was no miracle, then you have to explain how the evidence here in the testing device comes about. And that indeed must be a miracle then too. You know, if I have evidence for something that shouldn't be out here, then something must be broken here. That means somewhere here you might have your miracle, right? And so, but that shows it's not about adding up evidence. You know, maybe Hume would say, well, if you look long enough, you know, and you have then finally enough accumulative evidence that outweighs all this, perhaps then we could concede that, you know, but perhaps at most it's a draw or something like that. All of that is not the problem, really. The problem is you have a problem. That is, that there is something to be explained here is itself evidence for the miracle. Regardless of whether the miracle happens in this sequence of things or here, it is a miracle. It doesn't matter which side wins out, so to speak. So regardless of whether the laws of nature are broken in the observed event or in the testing device, it is a miracle. Even and precisely if it is a draw between the two, it is a miracle. Now this is important because this insight is applicable beyond the methods of forensic criminology. It does, for example, apply to the classic case of eyewitnesses. So again, think of the apostles, for example. For what is the eye if not a testing device? The eye, too, operates according to the laws of nature, such as the laws of optics and neurophysiology. And even if someone is deceived under certain ideal conditions, then we would still have to conclude that the miracle has occurred in the eye itself. And this, too, can and has been tested, for example, in cases of apparitions. We can look at the eyes of visionaries or something, if they're in ecstasy and so forth. And we can test repeatedly the evidence as well as the eye. Either way, it would be a miracle. If we were to dismiss this kind of evidence, we would have to dismiss our very evidence for the laws of nature as well. For we test the laws of nature with the same kind of devices. The ultimate devices available to us are our five senses, conveying sense experiences to us by organs like the eye. Any evidence against the witnesses of our own eyes can only consist in additional sense experiences, and therefore rely on the same kind of methods about which we pretend to be skeptical. Now, even if you read testing devices or other kind of tools in a laboratory, you use your eyes. You know, that's the bottom line. You know, you cannot go beyond that. Now, all of that includes even eyewitnesses of the historical past, of which Hume and many others tend to be dismissive. Witnesses, as they are treated in court, are just another sort of testing device. They might be broken devices indeed, but they nevertheless follow laws of their own that allow us to evaluate the evidence. Accordingly, no court dismisses eyewitnesses just because they are eyewitnesses. They do not dismiss them, but they evaluate their testimony. The methods of this evaluation are not unlike those that are used to establish the proper functioning of other kinds of tests and devices. But the behavior of witnesses has its own laws and regularities that enable us to assess the claims that are made. These regularities are not in principle different from those of the laws of nature, because they are established in the same way. In both cases, such regularities provide the most simple and coherent account of a large number of observed data. The data here being the behavior of the witnesses. To treat regularities about witnesses differently than regularities of nature would be an unwarranted ad hoc procedure for assessing evidence. So, for example, one of the established regularities about witnesses is that it is difficult for a liar to keep his story straight. was the first chancellor of the German Republic after the Second World War, Adenauer, said, "I never lie. My memory is not good enough." At a certain point, it would require an almost miraculous power of presence of mind and memory to keep your story straight. Still, it might be possible. But suppose we add to this the fact that multiple independent witnesses are consisting in telling a miracle story. Then the assumption of a lie would indeed constitute a coincidence more miraculous than assuming that they are speaking the truth. So either the miracle actually has happened, or there's a miracle in the witnesses. Had the miracle not occurred as reported or observed, then the agreement would itself be a miracle, just as it would be in the testing devices in our previous cases. Further information to be evaluated would include whether the witnesses are of doubtful character. So one can indeed, you know, say, well, they're just ignorant and barbarous, and sometimes that plays a role. But for what I just said, that plays no role. That's actually a regularity that applies regardless of whether you are stupid or barbarous or have a high IQ or whatever it is. You know? Nevertheless, under other circumstances, the moral character might play a role. Other things that are evaluated are whether the statements of independent witnesses are compatible, whether the agreement could have a special motivation, whether they speak with hesitation or too assertively, or have vested interests, and whether they happened to uphold their testimony even under torture and threat of death, which indeed would be the case for the apostles. Consider the apostles who independently were willing to die for their testimony with nothing to gain from it than what their testimony itself entailed, namely their own resurrection. It would be a miracle, you know, if they would die for something that they don't believe, you know, and that is not itself a testimony for their survival beyond that. Some of the evidence thus generated might only produce probabilities, but in many cases, assuming the opposite would really lead to real impossibilities. Scientists who would want to question the rigor of these criteria might do well to consider the procedures of their own disciplines and how much of their own evidence relies on the truthful testimony of other members of the scientific community. I don't want to go on too much longer. Let me just say one more thing. So all of that, you know, allows you to make a pretty good case for that a miracle has occurred, and that it is that the rational principle on which the evidence can be evaluated, and it's not irrational to change your mind to believing that a miracle existed. It happens analogously in many other cases too. One can even raise the probability of all of that and the plausibility if one allows further background knowledge. So let's say, for example, we have philosophical arguments for the existence of God. There are very good arguments for that, I would claim. And that by these proofs, we can also know that God is omnipotent and benevolent, and therefore likely to intervene if we are in need. Then, a priori, certain miracles would not be unlikely at all. If we know that we are in bad shape and we need God's help, and we know God exists, and we know God is good and omnipotent and can help us, then there's a great likelihood that God indeed would intervene, even miraculously. Then it is even more rational to believe that miracles have occurred. Background knowledge enters into the assessment of the probabilities of certain claims. That's what, you know, people will tell you, what so-called prior probabilities. And there is no reason in principle to say we must not allow that as evidence in the court, so to speak, or that background knowledge to influence what we are to think about this. It's not in principle different from other background knowledge that Hume adduces, namely the laws of nature. This is also background knowledge based on other kinds of arguments. So if we are not supposed to abstract from that, there's no reason why we should abstract from the background knowledge that comes from philosophical theology for the existence of God and the nature of God. If, on top of that, and maybe that's where I would end for now, if one can additionally show that the laws of nature require God to exist as their explanation, then both miracles and laws of nature are evidence for the same God that would work both. Laws of nature are actually not self-explanatory either. It's not only miracles that need explanations, the laws of nature also need explanations. Why does the world operate according to these regularities? That's not self-understood at all, though we will talk of its own. But someone who actually makes an argument for the existence of God based on that is Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton was actually a Christian apologist. People don't typically know that, but he used his physics for that. And he said, if you have laws of nature, you need a lawgiver. Right? And they're not self-explanatory. If that is so, then to appeal to the background knowledge of God is even more plausible. Right? And therefore, the way we assess miracle claims and the probability that they are true look quite differently suddenly. And so my case I'm making here so far, and there would be more things perhaps to talk about, but is that it is indeed rational to believe in miracles on principle. And there's no reason in principle to dismiss any kind of claim of miracles altogether. It is important to look at these claims and then need to assess the evidence. But all of that is a rational procedure and might very likely result into a positive assessment. Okay, I think I'll end here.